I used to be rather nasty about the polar bear because I didn't mean to be so nasty, but I used to say, you know, why is the image of climate change the polar bear rather than, you know, an indigenous woman desperately trying to cope with the situation?
Person.
A person, yeah. But, you know, I do understand about polar bears and I do like them.
you've come round. But I guess you were frustrated because that was the kind of people were kind of crying over the polar bears and you were meeting people and...
Yeah, that's right. I wanted a more people-centered approach, which also included polar bears and other mammals and sea and birds and everything, but put the people also in the centre, which climate negotiations weren't really doing. It's better now since the Paris Climate Agreement, but it took some time. Indigenous peoples have been wonderful in making this case over and over again and got to climate justice before any of us.
And I just want to say, if there are any polar bears listening, we still include, we're glad you've tuned in to the show today. We do care about you guys. But I don't know that they're supporting this podcast. I haven't gotten any tweets or any Instagram messages from not one polar bear. I think Mary's just catering to her audience, which is largely people.
What do you mean largely? Hello all, welcome to Mothers of Invention.
Yes, you're so welcome. That is Mary Robinson. Mary, I often introduce you as, you know, former Irish president. I talk about your UN work. So I looked you up on Wikipedia to see what different thing I could say today. And I saw in 2017 you were made a Knight of Freedom.
Oh, come on.
You're a knight. You're an actual knight.
I also have a big sabre.
You do?
Yeah, not a sword, but a sabre.
That, did that come with that?
That came with.
Polish knighthood?
Yes, absolutely. But listen, that's supposed to be a secret, but anyway.
Oh.
Not a secret, but just...
Wait, do you have the sabre on you right now?
No, but I've kept it in my office.
Oh, my God.
So if anybody intrudes...
Yeah, they know. Brienne of Tarth is ready for them. That's so cool.
Anyway, that's Maeve Higgins, who tortures me all the time, but apparently she's a pretty successful comedian, and she's also an actress and a truly fantastic writer. And I have to say, Maeve, I have to say that I really liked your New York Times article on climate justice last week. You know, it nearly moved me to tears.
Thank you.
Genuinely.
Oh, Mary, thank you. I wrote about why we shouldn't move to Mars, why we should keep our resources here on Earth, and of course the piece that I wrote was very informed by everything that I've learned by making this podcast with you. So I really have you to thank and all of these mothers of invention that you've introduced me to.
Well, you've learned a lot.
Yeah. I've learned everything there is to know. I'm the expert now.
Well, this week we trek to the Arctic, a region with so much life and diversity. We know that the ice caps are melting and that it's causing a subsequent sea level rise. But what we don't talk enough about is how these changes are affecting the Arctic's indigenous peoples.
Yeah, I'm realizing that I don't think I can even properly visualize a map of the Arctic, Mary.
In fact, the political borders are made up of Canada, Russia, the United States, Greenland, Norway, Finland, Sweden, and Iceland. But if you take those relatively modern borders away, what reveals itself is a distribution of more than 40 different indigenous groups who've lived there for millennia.
So we're going to get a proper tour of the Arctic from our guest host mother. This week's Mother of Invention is chair of the Inuit Circumpolar Council, Daily Sambodora. Welcome, Daily. Hi.
Hello. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for this opportunity.
Hello, Daily. Welcome to the show. We're really looking forward to talking to you.
I've never met you, Daily, but that's probably because I'm a comedian. Have you met Mary before?
Yeah, of course, you've played a role as chair of the UN Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues. And, you know, it's great to be in contact with you again. When I was High Commissioner, I had this responsibility of being coordinator of the Decade of Indigenous Peoples. With 400 million at least Indigenous people, probably more, are there, Daily?
Yes, I think that number is rather conservative. It's highly likely that there are more than 400 million Indigenous peoples across the globe.
You were very involved in those long-running negotiations for the Declaration on Indigenous Peoples. Tell us how important that was.
The UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples is highly significant. The fact that we now have a human rights regime within the United Nations that has been infused with perspectives of indigenous peoples is a big deal. And anyone who has not read the document should read the document.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It was a great breakthrough. It didn't happen in my time. You know, we were still discussing by the time I left in 2002. It's actually a very good human rights document. I mean, more power to those who insisted on making it as holistic and as rounded as possible.
Yes, that's right. And I think it's important for people to understand that this document doesn't create any new rights, but provides the distinct indigenous cultural context to existing rights, collective rights to self-determination, rights to lands, territories, and resources, food security, and a wide range of other fundamental human rights. And so it's significant in that way.
Yeah, it's one of the ways of fighting back in the Arctic Circle. You're a member of the Inuit who have had ancestry in Alaska for centuries, isn't that right?
Yes, that's right. I'm Inupiaq from northwest coast of Alaska.
All I know about the Inuit, at least one of the things I know, is that you have some wonderful sculptures.
Oh, yeah. Sculptures, ivory carvings, all kinds of creative expressions.
Yeah. And can you tell us a little bit more about the Inuit and where else in the Arctic they live?
Yes, the Inuit number approximately 165,000 reside in their traditional homelands in Chukotka of the Russian Far East, throughout the southwest, northwest, and north slope of Alaska, all throughout the Canadian Arctic, and around the whole coast of the island of Greenland.
And now you're leading the Inuit Circumpolar Council, which is really the best name for a governing body I've ever heard. What do you do with the ICC? What kind of work does it do?
Well, the main objective of the Inuit Circumpolar Council is to strengthen the unity among Inuit across these imposed borders, and also to promote our rights and interests at the international level. We have focused as well on issues related to the Arctic environment and pursue partnerships with various different organizations to achieve our objectives. We have focused more recently on a project here in Alaska and in Canada on food sovereignty and food security. So we do a wide range of things and basically really work to advance our human rights at the international level so that, you know, we can ensure our cultural integrity in the long run. We're really fortunate that the Inuit, as well as the Sami Council, the Aleut people through their international association, Athabascan and Gwich'in people, as well as the Russian Association of Indigenous Peoples of the North, are active within the Arctic Council.
I know one member of the Sami Council, Jani Staffordson, I think is her name. Do you remember her?
Yes, of course.
Do you kind of learn, for example, from the Sami people? I remember Jani talking about the thinning of the ice and the fact that if you have a change in temperature, that the reindeer can smell the nourishure, you know, deep down in the through the snow. But then when thin ice comes, they can't and they go further. And sometimes not just the reindeer, but the herders themselves are killed. They fall into thin ice. She was talking about using indigenous knowledge to try to avoid that. And I just wondered whether there are ways in which, in that context, you can learn from each other.
Oh, absolutely. In terms of our own observations, especially the active hunters and fishermen, the people out there and on the land, on the ice, out on the coastal seas, there's no question that there's an opportunity for cross-fertilization of knowledge.
Is that a big problem in Alaska? I mean, are you losing people?
Yes, there is a lot more risk and exposure and danger. I can't cite any specific numbers, but I do have an opportunity from time to time to hear the stories from individuals that have been out on the ice recently and escaping, near near death because of dramatic changes in the conditions.
Mm. We talk about mitigation and adaptation. They're now terms that we use to discuss climate resilience. Mitigation being the word we use for solutions that prevent or put a cap on greenhouse gas emissions. And then adaptation as the word we use when we have to change our behaviour for the inevitability of things getting worse. So what kind of resilience are you seeing that takes place in the Arctic? And what's the ratio, as far as you're concerned, between mitigation and adaptation strategies? Because that's a kind of climate justice issue.
Well, I think in terms of mitigation, a lot of our communities are looking to renewable energy and alternatives that have not really presented themselves in the past. Also, decreasing their reliance upon heavy fuel oil and heating oil within communities. Many of our people are really doing important outreach and dialogue through the Arctic Council and other fora to identify ways in which they can actually mitigate the impacts of climate change. I think that we've always been adaptable and resilient as Indigenous peoples, as Arctic Indigenous peoples, as Inuit. And I think that that is revealing itself in a wide array of methods and approaches. And
that's so interesting, because I think on this podcast, we often talk to Indigenous communities and people of color, and they kind of remind everybody else, this isn't the first apocalypse they've faced. Like, they have this resilience because they've had to build it up over the years, you know. Would you say that's the case?
Oh, absolutely. If you think about the Inuit and the cold Arctic environment, the harsh environment, and, and the resiliency, the ability to survive in conditions that most would definitely shy away from. I guess one other thing.
Yeah, I wouldn't last 2 minutes. I mean, we were joking earlier, like, what would happen if I lost my phone? But I'd just be up there. I'd have the wrong coat on, and I wouldn't know how to use the dogs. I'd keep them as pets instead of working, and, you know, it would be a nightmare.
The Northern Bering Sea Climate Resilience Area, which President Obama signed into action by executive order, took extraordinary efforts from the Indigenous communities in Alaska. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
So the North Bering Sea, that's the stretch of water on the west coast of Alaska, is that right? But it borders Russia?
Yes, I think it was really extraordinary that President Obama came to Alaska, that he went above the Arctic Circle, but significantly the Norton Sound area, the region that I'm from, the Bering Sea Elders Group and Melanie Banke and other people at Kowarik and the coastal communities of the area really put a lot into the development of this resilience area, and wanted to ensure that their views and perspectives, their Indigenous knowledge about the area was protected. It was significant because the Inuit reliance upon the marine environment and the marine mammals was underscored in that executive order. And the role that they played in terms of the fisheries, their own Indigenous knowledge, their own perspectives, the work that they've done on mapping the area, and the fact that the effort to really look at how shipping and increased vessel traffic should be monitored and minimized, but significantly oil and gas development, that there would be a off-limits area. So if you think about the Inuit coastal communities and the importance of the marine environment, this was a perfect opportunity to ensure climate resilience, and it's just unfortunate that this current administration doesn't see the world in the same way as Inuit.
Can you tell us about this, the fishing treaty for the Arctic that was signed last year? I understand it was about 10 years in the making.
Yes, the Central Arctic Ocean Fisheries Agreement, mm-hmm. where there is a moratorium on any commercial activity or unregulated commercial fishing in this high seas area of the Central Arctic Ocean. That is an extraordinary agreement for a number of different reasons. First of all, I should say that the Inuit Circumpolar Council was afforded an opportunity to have our people as direct participants in the negotiations through the government of the U.S., Canada, and Denmark. And the Inuit were the only indigenous peoples in the Arctic region to have direct participants in the actual negotiations. And I think it's significant that the precautionary principle is integrated into this.
Good.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And it's one of the few places where this has taken place, where people can
that's
see.
That's a good example. Yeah, great.
Exactly. To see on the horizon that that this could become an area of activity, but let's be careful and cautious about how we move forward. It's significant also that this particular legal agreement between the five Arctic coastal states plus five others references the importance of indigenous knowledge. It also references the need to have the Inuit as Arctic indigenous peoples participate in the development of their science program. It's also one of the few, if not the only, international legal agreement that makes specific reference to the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples.
Can I just ask you a question, you know, that I was thinking about as you were speaking? You know, why is there not more protection for the Arctic like there is for Antarctica? I don't understand why one is so much more protected than the other.
That's an excellent question. I think that probably because we have so many powerful political and economic interests as well as potential.
Too many neighbors pushing in. Yeah.
No, that's exactly right. That's exactly the case. And also, even though we've had a good level of influence within the Arctic Council, we're equally concerned about the interest and the increasing interest of non-Arctic states like China and Japan, India, Korea, Singapore, and they're all looking at, you know, what kind of designs can they put in place in the Arctic for their own benefit, not necessarily the benefit of Arctic indigenous peoples.
So we have a lot of work to do to help stop some of these things from progressing further. And, you know, thinking about the Arctic really brings out what we talk about in a climate context, listening to the wisdom, to the right to participate and to have the voice heard and to bring the knowledge to the table. You know, that's so important. I'm really excited because I'm going to Greenland in August. I'm going on one of these, scientific visits to see what's happening in Greenland.
Lucky you.
Yeah, I think it'll be very interesting. They say that Greenland is so instructive now of just how quickly things are changing, isn't it?
80% of Greenland is actually covered in an ice sheet. Daly, correct me if I'm wrong. The ice sheet reflects so much of the sun's energy back into space. That's how it helps us to moderate temperatures. Like on the rest of the planet, it actually acts as kind of a thermostat.
No, that's exactly right. And if you look at a current map of Greenland, a majority of it is an ice sheet and ice covered.
Hmm. But it's losing its mass, isn't it?
Yes, and the past predictions seemingly have been met, and it's kind of unfortunate to know, at least from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that it may be happening much faster than previously expected. What I understand from the recent Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in the Arctic and Antarctic region, we may be seeing a 40% faster increase in loss of sea ice and ice generally than in other parts of the world, or certainly the impacts of climate change being much more intense at both the North Pole and the South Pole. I don't know the science on that, but from Indigenous knowledge and the changes that people are seeing out there and on the ground within our communities, that there is much more dramatic change in conditions. It means that we have invasive species entering the ecosystem, the environment that we have relied upon for centuries. Also, the melting sea ice is generating increased vessel traffic. Also, yes. There's much more opportunity from, I would say, probably the extractive industries.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, people want to explore the potential of the Arctic, and they want to extract all kinds of oil and whatever else there may be. It's pretty shocking.
I also wanted to ask you about cosmology, which is a concept that's come up frequently when we talk about climate with our Indigenous mothers, but it's not as much part of Western rhetoric, I suppose.
That's exactly right. I think that what we've just shared in terms of a more holistic view of the environment, mm-hmm. in addition that, and it is recognized in the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, that Indigenous peoples, including Inuit, have a unique and distinct and profound relationship with the environment that they live within, and see themselves often as a part of that environment, as a species within the environment, much in the same way as the whale is a species within the environment. So mm-hmm. I think it absolutely is a very different perspective and a very different cosmology. This has come up when people talk about management of resources, and most Western scientists in particular have a view that they can somehow control the environment, when in fact really what we're talking about is controlling the behavior of humans in the environment.
Yes, stopping the sense that this is something that's a resource for us that we can either extract or somehow benefit from, as opposed to live sustainably with.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, that's right. And then you can also think about it in terms of the relationship that, I mean, if you believe that you are a species within the environment, along with all other species, that knowledge, that observation, I mean, there are just important contributions that can be made by Inuit and other Indigenous peoples because of that relationship.
Our next mother is Ariel Duranje. She is Dene of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation, and her people are located in Alberta up in Canada. She's the executive director of the Indigenous Climate Network, and Ariel is an extraordinary activist who's campaigning against the tar sands that are destroying her ancestral lands.
My parents met via the American Indian Movement between like the late 60s and into the early mid 70s. The historic battle happened at a place called Wounded Knee in the 1800s, and there was a reoccupation of the Black Hills to protect them against uranium mining. And my parents were involved with that. Thousands of people went to Wounded Knee, onto South Dakota, Pine Ridge, Oglala, and the Lakota Nation territory, where they were fighting against uranium mining and the sale of their lands and territories to developers in the region. So it became a historical moment because there was gunfire, back and forth. There was FBI involvement. It was a very heavy, heavy moment in the American Indian Movement.
What about the reports of exchanges of gunfire that we hear about here at the Siege of Wounded Knee?
That happens every night. The federal government, of course, claims we fire first, which that claim is asinine. It's beyond belief. Our sentries along our borders are given 10 rounds of ammunition apiece each night because we haven't that much ammunition. And besides that, it would be foolhardy, to say the least, for us to attempt to militarily engage the most powerful country militarily in the history of mankind.
My mom always says I was literally born into resistance because when my mom was 8.5 months pregnant, our family was forcibly removed from our traditional territory by armed security for a uranium company granted the concessions to develop uranium in our lands and territory. And that really manifested into my whole childhood and upbringing, really standing up for our rights as Indigenous peoples, standing up for the protection and preservation of our traditional territories. And that means protests. Iklanate, Dene Sotlaneta, Ariel Tsaekwe Hushe, Durange Betsy and Ihesli. My name is Ariel Tsaekwe Durange, and I'm a member of the Athabasca Chipewyan First Nation. I'm a Dene Sotlane, or Dene, woman, and our communities are located primarily in the most northern parts of Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Alberta, parts of British Columbia, Yukon, and the Northwest Territories. So we're Arctic and sort of sub-Arctic cultures and people. Canada's boreal forest is such an amazing and beautiful ecosystem. As Dene people, the word Dene, when you break it down into its two root words, de and ne, de means to flow, and ne means from the land. And so we as people flow from the land, and our namesake connects us with those spaces. I was fortunate enough to have grown up with parents that taught me the value of not just the ecosystems, but our relationship with those ecosystems. The rocks, the rivers, the grass, the trees, the plants, the medicines, the birds, the fish, the moose, the caribou, the bison, the deer, the rabbits, and so on and so forth. They are all of our relatives. And we are no more and we are no less, and we are just a part of those systems. I grew up, you know, living in a tent for sometimes 2 months at a time in the year with my parents on the land, hauling water, collecting and trapping and hunting our foods every day, and really thinking about how you live with nature, the sounds, the smells, the feels of the natural world it's a very visceral, deep, intimate relationship. It's very pure and it's very full of love and light. And I remember these places, you know, these streams and these river systems and the forests and the sounds of the bugs and the amphibians and the birds and even just the sounds of the trees. My parents separated when I was about 12 years old, and I didn't go up to my territory for almost a decade. And when I went back, I drove over towards where the major operations are. And it is nothing but a desolate landscape. So my memories as a child in that region are lush forests and all this beautiful biodiversity. And then I come over this hill after not being there for 10 years, in which the oil sands expansion had really, really ramped up. When I say it's desolate, I mean it is desolate. It's nothing but gray sand, all fenced in because it's so toxic. And then just beyond that, you see big trucks and shovel operations and nothing but black sand and tar sands everywhere. And the scene from Lord of the Rings, and I know it sounds cliche, where they come over and they are through the lush forest and suddenly they come upon Mordor. It is literally that feeling. It is literally like experiencing that. But imagine those places are your home. Imagine those places are your relatives that have been torn apart and ripped apart and left as nothing but corpses and bones on the landscape. And that is what it was like for me. And I remember just feeling like someone was sitting on my chest, like someone had just hit me in the chest, and I was overwhelmed by grief, like actual grief. And I couldn't breathe, and my ears started ringing, and I just sat there. I just started crying, like silently crying. And it was that moment that changed me for the rest of my life. I can't explain the north enough. I mean, northern lights or boreal on the regular almost every day. We have wonderful, beautiful landscapes that grow lush and green with like the midnight sun, meaning the sun barely sets, it just goes below the horizon. The air and the silence is so immense and beautiful. Canada's boreal forest sequesters twice that of the Amazon. We don't have as many diverse species, but the species in which we have sequester carbon at a higher rate. And so we have these really immense soils and peatlands and bogs that are like tens of meters deep. And they take centuries. And this is not an exaggeration. They take centuries to develop. So this is in the high Arctic where we don't have these massive trees like they do in the Amazon. But what we do is we're going the other way. Our sequestration is in the ground. And we have these deep systems of lichen and muskegs, we call them muskegs, which are peatlands and bogs, that are tens of meters deep and take thousands of years to develop. And a lot of them are held in place by permafrost. And as that permafrost starts to melt, it's destabilizing those systems. Lungs come in pairs. And the Amazon is the lungs of the southern hemisphere, and the boreal is the lungs of the northern hemisphere. And just like the Amazon, the indigenous peoples are some of the most vital voices for the protection and preservation of those ecosystems and have been safeguarding and protecting those places for millennia. For us, the Athabasca Delta, the Treaty 8 territory where my people come from, was full of the bounty of the natural living world. And it supplied us with so much for our physical selves through the food systems, through our mental and spiritual selves, through the procurement that we had through our cultural ceremonies. And right now, the Athabasca territory is being really developed for the Alberta tar sands. It's a crude oil. It's not your sweet conventional oil. It's much thicker. It's much harder to extract. But it is the second largest recoverable oil reserve in the world. It's the third largest oil reserve in the world, third to Venezuela, and only second to Saudi Arabia. Tar sands is a heavy crude oil that is mixed with clay and minerals and other rocks in the ground. And so it's not like a system of oil that you can just simply pump jack out of the ground. It has to be extracted in very, very energy intensive methodologies. One is through open pit mining. That has to be further processed by taking fresh water from water systems, mixing it with solvents and chemicals, and the oil mixed with all this sand and rock. The other extraction method is very much like fracking. It's called in situ, and it requires a series of pipelines to be put into the ground where they superheat and pressurize water to melt the oil sands. And even once they've done all of this, this oil is still a very crude oil that has to be processed sometimes 2 to 3 more times, which again is very energy intensive. Talk about why our lands are so attractive to multinational corporations and governments is that there's a different value set that drives European colonists. The indigenous populations lived in this symbiotic relationship with our ecosystems where everything was our relation. Colonization was predicated on this idea that indigenous peoples were not people under, you know, things like the doctrine of discovery and terra nullius, which was that we were just simply a part of the flora and fauna, and that man had the ability to have man's dominion over those spaces. The largest industrial project on planet Earth will only be a few dozen kilometers away from our traditional lands and territories. And what we've had is this lip service, this, yes, we see you, and we're sorry for all the things we've done, but we're not going to stop doing them.
We have to stand up and fight back.
We are asking Credit Suisse to divest from the companies who are causing indigenous human rights violations across the world. I'm asking you, stand with us for the earth and the water.
We're in the climate crisis. So we have to find a way to work with what we've got. So when I think about that, I go, okay, so what do we need? Governments need a wake-up call that we can't base it on whether or not we have a good GDP and how much money we have in the bank, and include giving Indigenous nations nationhood status and decision-making powers over our lands and territories beyond the parameters of the reservations or the reserve systems. So with divestments, it was a learning curve for me. I got a job with the Rainforest Action Network. And so instead of focusing on pushing corporations to look at their carbon footprint, we pushed corporations to look at their impact and sort of footprint, so to speak, on the rights of Indigenous communities. We started this platform of divestment in 2008 to 2011. You know, Indigenous women were traveling across Europe and the UK to ask for divestment of tar sands from the big banks, from hedge funds and pension funds. And it has actually amounted into a massive amounts of divestments in the Alberta tar sands, including a couple of the companies even withdrawing their applications and projects. And it started to build this human rights, Indigenous rights-based framework of divestment associated with high-emitting projects. And it has completely changed the game in how we look at divestment, not just in Canada, but globally. Of course, big oil is this massive entity, energy, being, beast, monster, whatever you want to call it. And it can be incredibly scary. And I've absolutely wondered what the hell I'm doing, you know. But it is the power of our people to continue to stand up, to continue to speak our languages when we were literally beaten to not speak our languages, to continue our culture and our ceremonies when they were outlawed, that I still know what it means to be Dene Sotlane. The fact is colonization didn't win. It didn't work. We're pushing the boundaries of what solutions mean and how we take next steps to protect not just our communities, but the overall climate. You know, this podcast is Mothers of Invention, and it's about women. And one of the most interesting and magical and amazing things is that in this movement of climate justice and environmental justice, it's Indigenous women that are rising to the forefronts. When it comes to how we envision solutions, even though we live in an energy-rich part of the country, our homes are still powered by diesel tanks attached to all of our homes. And so we're moving away from that and building the largest off-grid solar farm. And we just finished building a cooperative grocery store to address the food insecurity. And that will be supplemented by the construction of greenhouses. It's women restoring that balance and pushing down this idea that men have all the power. When we do this, we're not just talking about masculine and feminine. We're talking about restoring the balance between the relationship with the natural world. We have to abandon being human-centric. We have to move beyond, you know, sort of this paternalistic relationship that we have in which the government sort of declares what's good or what's bad. And that's largely because these systems were never created for us. We have to abandon this idea that men know everything and that women need to rise up and restore that balance on this planet. And for me, I've just seen it happen. So many women. And when I see the resiliency, when I see the solutions that are being created, I can't help but have hope. I can't help but believe that we are going to be okay. So Indigenous Climate Action is an organization led by Indigenous women, and our primary work is really centered around inspiring Indigenous communities to build Indigenous-led climate solutions. Check out our website, www.indigenousclimateaction.com. There's a donate button if you feel inspired to donate, but we also are looking for volunteers all the time. Really think about how you can invest and work with your local Indigenous communities. Figure out who they are, meet your neighbors, find out about the history of your country and where you're from.
Wow. We hear some extraordinary stories on the show, but that might be the most emotional I've gotten listening to an interview, you know. It's horrifying how much Indigenous communities have to cope with, you know, everywhere. But to have grown up in the Arctic in a time when you can see the changes happen so dramatically with your own eyes, and to think that all of them are man-made, it must be infuriating. I think I'd like anger cry all day long.
You know, all of this has to stop. That's the truth of it, especially these tar sands. It's just not tolerable, given that we have to reduce by 45% our carbon emissions by 2030, and that's 11 years away. So we just can't go on like this. I mean, when are we going to get sense?
Throughout the Arctic, not only is it the potential for oil and gas development, but also the impacts of mining and the fact that various different minerals as well as rare earth elements have been charted and identified, and exploratory activity taking place, that the increased opportunity because conditions are easier to work under due to climate change is another compounding pressure that Arctic Indigenous peoples are facing.
I must say, as the coordinator of the Decade of Indigenous Peoples, I had great sympathy for the Indigenous peoples in Canada who were trying to stop the tar sands. It's a very destructive, terrible form of extraction.
And that was happening back when you were working with them as well?
Yeah.
When we were doing the research for this piece, the producers told me that Indigenous people in Canada didn't even have the right to vote until 1960.
They have terrible discrimination and terrible abuse of residential schools. I mean, there's been a huge exposure. It's a bit like the problem in Ireland.
Ariel is the first generation of her family not to be sent to residential schools, actually. Where, you know, as you said, like in Ireland, you have to abandon your culture, you have to assimilate to colonial expectations. She also was the first generation not to live on her ancestral lands because of changing landscapes and seizing family properties through Canadian law.
The Indian Act was highly discriminatory, especially towards Indian women, and remains a contentious issue to this day. So I think for mothers of invention, that's worth noting. Yeah. The gender discrimination embedded in the Indian Act.
Yeah.
What was the gender discrimination? Was it again to do with voting rights or?
Access to land and land rights, that it was along the lines of gender. So, for example, similar to some of the Pueblos in Southwest United States, if a woman married outside of the community, then she was essentially disinherited as far as land and membership and other issues are concerned. I don't know all the details about the matter. The Inuit weren't impacted by the Indian Act itself, but there were many discriminatory provisions.
It's always been a very big complaint and long running problem for, as you say, for those affected by it in Canada.
And you know Tara Hauska, who we met in the first season, she's up there now, and that's her point as well, because they're kind of getting reductions. Like in December, it was like, we'll reduce it by 8%, and she's saying no. Yeah. She's fighting with the water protectors to stop these pipelines because it's protecting drinking water, stopping, you know, this expansion, this constant expansion of fossil fuels, and you just need to accelerate the just transition to clean energy. So there's mothers that are doing that, but you're right, really,
no,
it's
business
like
as usual. It's
piecemeal
not
isn't really going to cut it, you know.
No, we've got to be more radical.
Activism works.
I'm really impressed by the way that Ariel has travelled to banks in various countries and persuaded them to divest from fossil fuels.
Yeah, that's right. Here in New York City and New York State, just this month, there have been big announcements on the intention to divest funds from fossil fuels. But for New York City, at least, that's 2 years down the line. And they're still just talking about it when really there's no time to waste. Wow. You know, I feel really lucky to have had Ariel's story on our show. Like, what a life. And it's just an incredible story.
I'm so glad that we covered this subject this week. Daly, thank you so much for sharing so much of your wisdom and your knowledge from the Arctic. Please do keep us posted on your work on the Arctic Council and indeed the Inuit Circumpolar Council. Keep fighting.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that's the motto of Indigenous peoples across the globe. And we have to remain optimistic about our future.
How can people learn more about your work and stay in touch, Daly?
Well, I would invite listeners to educate themselves about the Inuit Circumpolar Council by visiting our website, by reading the various publications that exist both on the website and elsewhere, also reading the declarations that the Inuit Circumpolar Council has adopted. I would also urge people to look at the various films that are emerging. The film Angry Inuk by Inuit women in Canada is quite significant. There's a forthcoming film. I hope it gets a popular release here in the United States. It's entitled The Grizzlies.
And it focuses, I like the title.
It's quite unusual. It focuses on the unfortunate and harrowing reality of suicide within the Canadian Arctic Inuit communities, but I absolutely hope that it gets viewing across the United States. It's forthcoming. Yeah, in fact, anybody who has ideas about screening of it in the United States should be in touch with the producers.
Brilliant.
You've been great,
Daly.
It's been so informative. Yeah. And I love the fact that, you know, you're constantly referencing the, you know, traditional knowledge, the participation, the voice of Indigenous peoples. Keep it up.
Kliyanak. Thank you very much. All right. Take care, Mary.
Okay.
Take care,
Maeve.
Hope to see you in person.
Thank you. Yes, you too. Thank you. Bye.
If you'd like to learn more about Daly or Ariel's work or any of our past mothers, you can learn more on our website, Mothers of Invention Online, to find out how to support their endeavours, and they are so worthy of support.
That's right. And what do you want to hear more about? What do you feel the big issues are? What should we be talking about here on Mothers of Invention? Send us your ideas or nominate somebody today. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram at Mothers Invent. So, Mary, I hear you're going to be on the Laura Flanders Show.
Yes, she interviewed me in Bellagio last week. We were at the same women's leadership meeting, Dangerous Women.
Ooh.
And it was a good interview, I think. I certainly was very impressed by Laura because I know her. We were in Bellagio together beforehand.
Yeah.
And this was nice to be back. And she's a good listener. And, you know, maybe I talk too much, but I think it was quite good.
No, I'm sure it was great. She has a really good show. So, yeah, I'm going to promote it right now, not just because you're on it. Laura is another Brooklynite, and she always has interesting guests on her show. She focuses, as she says, on the people, places and movements who are making radical change and shifting power. So you can actually subscribe to her show on iTunes, Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts. Mary, I don't know which platform you like yourself for all of these podcasts that you listen to.
No comment.
You've definitely been on more podcasts than you've listened to, I suspect. But there's a big thumbs up for the Laura Flanders Show from us here at Mothers of Invention.
And we're very happy to do it. Mothers of Invention is a production of Doc Society and is made possible by the support of our partners, the Climate Justice Resilience Fund, the Compton Foundation, the Wallace Global Fund, the Children's Investment Fund Foundation and the European Climate Foundation, and of course, our loyal DRIP crowdfunders.
Our series producer is Thamali Kodikara. The executive producers are Jess Search and Beatty Finzi. Our audio producers and mixers are Anne Pope and Jeannie Hopper. Jada Santa is our researcher, and Aisha Yunus is our resident social media genius. Daly's interview was taped at KNBR Anchorage by Trip Krause, and Ariel's was taped at CPUA in Edmonton by Elliot Garnier. Additional recording by Riva Goldberg. Our climate expert consultants are Iris Andrews, Ed King and Catherine Wilkinson. Our theme music is Water Fountain by Tuneyards with kind permission from 4AD and Marriage Records. Additional music is from Poddington Bear.